loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump has decided to shut down his embattled and much criticized personal charitable foundation amid allegations that he used it for personal and political gain. New York Attorney General Barbara Underwood said the president had also agreed to give away the remaining money. She added that the foundation had engaged in what she called, quote, a shocking pattern of illegality, unquote. Next, headlines in all major U.S. newspapers and news websites today crowed about the firing of former CBS chief Les Moonves for sexual misconduct. But even in this Me Too era, nearly every headline mentioned Moonves' loss of a $120 million severance package, but did not mention the accusations against him. Then, U.S. negotiators in Abu Dhabi yesterday met with members of the Taliban leadership and representatives of the Afghan government to discuss a possible peace in Afghanistan. It's possible that the Taliban and government delegations could meet face-to-face for the first time. The talks were supposed to last 1 day, but they've stretched into a second, raising hopes of substantive advances. And then in a speech marking the 40th anniversary of China's economic reform, President Xi Jinping vowed to continue market liberalization, but made no major policy announcements. He asserted the importance of strong Communist Party control of the economy and society, and said in a reference to the United States that no master can control the Chinese people. Meanwhile, the intelligence chiefs of the Five Eyes countries met in Nova Scotia to discuss Chinese electronics giant Huawei. And finally, the Trump administration earlier this year laid out plans to weaken emission controls on vehicles. The changes were so dramatic that even automakers balked at the notion of making and selling dirtier cars and trucks. But it turns out that another group was behind the push. The New York Times reports that it was U.S. oil companies leading the charge to allow cars and trucks to emit more pollution. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the Trump Foundation. President Trump has decided to shut down his embattled and much criticized personal charitable foundation amid allegations that he used it for personal and political gain. New York Attorney General Barbara Underwood said the president had also agreed to give away the remaining money. She added that the foundation had engaged in what she called a shocking pattern of illegality. We're joined from New York by Ted Rall, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at www.rall.com. Welcome back, Ted.
Thank you.
Ted, there's a terrific piece in the Washington Post today that really lays out this whole story, and it is a shocking pattern of illegality, and not just that, but immorality. Brian and I were talking about this just before we started this segment, and the Washington Post documents, for example, some donations, and I use air quotes around the word donations, in 1989, where the largest donation ever in the history of this foundation went to restore a fountain in front of one of Donald Trump's hotels, and then the smallest donation also appeared that year. It was $7 to the Boy Scouts, which just coincidentally happened to be the cost of enrolling Don Jr. in the Cub Scouts. The article goes on to say that Donald Trump used almost none of his own money to finance this foundation. In recent years, it says the largest gifts came from pro wrestling moguls Vince and Linda McMahon, not from Trump. So my question to you then is, why is nobody being prosecuted criminally for this in the state of New York?
Well, first of all, I would just like to point out that in a time of polarization, it's nice to see that the Clintons do really have a lot in common with Donald Trump in terms of the way they run a foundation. There should be prosecution. I mean, it really does seem like a classic slap on the wrist. I mean, the Trumps are no longer going to be allowed under this consent decree to be members of this foundation, and they have to, and there's going to be $2.8 million in restitution. I want this is where we're supposed to have like the Dr. Evil finger on the chin kind of $2.8 million. This is a guy who's supposedly worth $5 billion. So it's a little galling, and it does seem to me like this foundation was obviously used as a money laundry and a tax shelter. And this happens a lot, actually. I think maybe that's why the prosecution's not very zealous. Or it could just be that, he's a president of the United States and They're not going to try to march him out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue that way.
Some people don't understand how the charity works, so I think we need to explain it a little bit. A 501c3 charity means that it has tax deductibility for donors. So donors make a donation to the Donald Trump Charity Foundation, and then they can take that money off of their income, their reported income that's a taxed income. So let's say I give $1 million to the foundation. A certain part of that $1 million, I can say, is tax deductible depending on the size of my income. And then I don't have to pay taxes on it. In exchange for getting the donation that has tax deductibility, that's a way to not have to pay taxes, the charity is supposed to do good things with the money, meaning it's supposed to live up to its mission. And its mission is usually of a humanitarian or of an educational character. But in this case, the foundation was, for instance, I bought a portrait of Donald Trump for $10,000 that it was put into its country club.
Yeah, it went to one of his country clubs.
Wait, wasn't that it? I mean, that was another one. Corey Lewandowski, who was for a while Donald Trump's campaign manager. Remember, Trump skipped the Iowa Republican debate and held his own event for veterans, and he raised $2.8 million. That's where the $2.8 million comes from. And then used the money to give out to veterans groups during the rest of the campaign. You're not supposed to use money donated to a charity for expressed political purposes. Maybe this wasn't expressed political purposes, but it was raised as a campaign rally and then distributed to veterans groups as the campaign unfolded. You're not supposed to do that.
No, it's illegal. And the president has repeatedly called for that law to be repealed since he was inaugurated.
Yeah. Ted, you're a New Yorker. You wrote the graphic novel on Donald Trump. Is any of this a surprise to you?
Not at all. I guess what's a little surprising to me in all these kinds of cases is that such incredibly wealthy, prominent men with so many attorneys, or at least potentially high-powered attorneys, just a phone call away, choose not to follow the law and to break the law, not bend the law, but break it so brazenly. And they do it over and over again. And the only possible conclusion that I can draw is that either they're crazy or their experience has taught them that they can get away with anything. And I suspect that it's a lot more number two than number one.
Yeah. Again, Donald Trump made fun of this lawsuit by the New York State Attorney General not too long ago, back in June 2018. This is what Trump wrote or tweeted, of course. The sleazy New York Democrats and their now disgraced and run out of town AG Eric Schneiderman are doing everything they can to sue me on a foundation that took in $18,800,000 and gave out to charity more money than it took in, $19,200,000. I won't settle this case. That's Donald Trump's.
He always says that.
June 14, 2018. But this is the thing about Donald Trump. I mean, workers in New York and vendors in New York who work for the Trump organization, they know they're probably not going to get paid. They're not going to be paid. If they are paid at all, they're not going to be paid what they were told they were going to be paid. The guy who won the hole-in-one contest that Trump sponsored for his foundation, the Trump Foundation at Mar-a-Lago, they didn't pay him when he got the hole-in-one.
No, they said that there was that it was 3 feet shorter than what it was supposed to be according to the insurance company.
I mean, this is Donald Trump. This is Donald Trump. It's always about money. It's like like Donald Trump Jr. when he turned 11, they paid $7 out of the foundation to the Boy Scouts because that was the minimum cost to join the Boy Scouts when Donald Trump Jr. was 11. Because Donald Trump could save $7.
It's totally him. And let's not forget, recently he owes Elizabeth Warren $1 million because she did prove she had Native American ancestry.
I forgot about that.
Another bizarre and absurd part of this campaign.
It's so hard to keep track of it all. He's famous. He's infamous for this. And everyone knows he's a liar and perhaps most damning in a capitalist system. He doesn't make good on his business contracts. Contract law is everything in this country. This guy just, you can't trust him at all. But it's unbelievably sleazy, and it does seem that he has gotten away with this. There's definitely people who are cooling their heels in club fed for doing a lot less.
Oh, yeah. I got to tell you, minimum security prisons across the country are bursting at the seams for people who did this or less than this.
Donald Trump also said he wouldn't settle the Trump University lawsuit, but that too, that's they had to shut that down too, and Trump also had to pay a $25 million fine. That was brought by former students at Trump University. You know what, though, Ted Rall, the pattern of Donald Trump, you know, being all about money, being probably corrupt, but probably around fake air quotes. Again, all of this, though, is because it comes under the aegis of constant criminal investigations by those who politically are opposed to Donald Trump being president of the United States. If he had not become president, or if Michael Flynn had not become national security advisor, or if Paul Manafort had not become the campaign chairman for Donald Trump, none of these things would be happening, even though pretty much everybody in power knew about them beforehand.
That's really true. And that's it, it adds a whole like layer of disgustingness to it, because not only because you have this guy, he's a scumbag and he deserves to be prosecuted. But the people who are prosecuting him are really not much better, because they're just doing it for partisan political reasons. So there's really, you know, this is, it's not a Hollywood story. There's no one you can look up to in this story and say, wow, they're, you know, they're really the good guys, those New York prosecutors, or Robert Mueller, or, you know, or all the media companies that are cheering them on, or certainly not Trump or his gang of cronies. They're all scum. You can hate them all. It's okay to hate them all. I do.
Yeah. Ted Rall hates them all, John. And again, what we said about the Trump Foundation, or what's being said, again, we could do many, many shows about the Clinton Foundation.
Absolutely.
That was a cash cow for the Clintons, and it was a pay-to-play for a lot of people who wanted to buy influence, either at the State Department or with the White House. Anyway.
Yeah, they knew exactly what they were doing. Okay, we were joined from New York by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, and you can check out his work at www.rall.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after this.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Headlines in all major U.S. newspapers and news websites today crowed about the firing of former CBS chief Les Moonves for sexual misconduct. But even in this Me Too era, nearly every one of those headlines mentioned Moonves' loss of a $120 million severance package, but did not mention the accusations against him. We're joined from Geneva, New York by Jody Dean. She's a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and her latest book is Crowds and Parties. Welcome back, Jody.
Oh, thanks so much.
Jody, we talk amongst ourselves here at the studio, and one of the things that we have been talking about is how Les Moonves, for whatever reason, seems to, how can I say this, even go through something like this with his reputation largely intact, and it's because it's as though there's a cover-up among major media outlets to not go into the details of what he's been accused of doing. You look at these headlines. I'm gonna read some of the headlines from today. CBS says Les Moonves will not receive $120 million severance. CBS denies former CEO Les Moonves $120 million severance. Les Moonves won't get a penny of his $120 million severance, et cetera, et cetera. It's not about what he did. It's not about the people that he made victims. Why is that?
I think it has to be that the mainstream media is really preoccupied with the wealth and power of head executives. Right? They're bewitched by it. They love it. They envy it. They aspire to it. They fully identify with it. So Moonves for them is like the aspiration of what they all want. And so, of course, they're going to be completely corrupt, completely just biased against women, unable to recognize the harms that Moonves and the entire CBS culture have done to women. You know, one of the things that's completely obscene about this story is it also doesn't tell you how much he's worth. He's worth about $700 million. This is before the non-severance payment. He's also has earned the past few years $69 million a year. So it's not like somehow he's being done an injustice. I mean, the story should be, how come come he's not in jail? Because it was clear that he also destroyed evidence in order to protect his reputation. And how come they're not highlighting the fact that he was the center, the beating heart of an incredible culture of sexual exploitation and violence against women at CBS for years?
You know, actually, one of the questions that I wanted to put to you was, why are there no criminal charges here? It was the CBS board that came out and said that one of the reasons why he's being denied the money is that he destroyed the evidence of his own crime. Why aren't the authorities involved in something like this?
You know, it doesn't make sense to me, except in the big picture way that, you know, the law works for the rich and screws the poor, right? For the most part, there will be all sorts of investigations of an everyday person, or particularly a person of color, a working class person of color, or working class white person. If they do the slightest thing wrong, then the authorities are on them. They're just totally in, you know, their fingers in every aspect of their lives. But when someone is that rich, it's like the legal system is like too afraid to touch them. It's like, oh no, well, we give you the benefit of the doubt, Mr. Rich Man, but anybody else isn't going to get it. So I think it's an example of the way that money and power continue to work in our culture, to give a legal system that really benefits the very rich and hurts the rest of us.
Moonves also said in his position as CEO of CBS, when asked about the free coverage that was given to candidate Donald J. Trump, constant free coverage by CBS, by CNN, by all of them, because it was good for ratings. Moonves actually was honest. He said, well, this may be really bad for the country, but it's great for CBS. Meaning later, all of their protestations against Trump, or all of their later reporting that somehow the Kremlin made Trump the president of the United States, when Moonves in that candid moment was saying, yeah, we're making this second-rate, third-rate, fourth-rate, fourth-tier candidate Donald J. Trump, somebody, a reality, a TV show, eclipsed star, a thing. It was because of all that free coverage. This is the same person, everybody. This is the guy who helped make Donald J. Trump president and then went on to blame Russia for the fact that we have somebody so odious as Donald J. Trump as president of the United States.
Yeah, it's completely absurd, but it's about the money for them, right? Money and ratings. And if something's going to bring them ratings, they can bring down the country. In the same way, if something is going to get in the way of a powerful person that is actually bringing in the money, bringing in the ratings, and by getting in the way, meaning saying you don't get to command my body, you don't get to touch me whenever you want, then people turn the other way. They're gonna do whatever they can to let the money keep flowing, you know, come what may, whether or not it's destroying democracy, destroying women's lives, creating an obscene culture of just total exploitation.
Tell me, with the way this case is ending up, a forfeiture of a considerable sum of money for you and me, maybe not for him, but for you and me, but no criminal prosecution, is there any way in which this outcome is going to discourage other executives, other high-ranking, very wealthy people from engaging in the kind of behavior that got Les Moonves in trouble, or no? Is this too much of a slap on the wrist?
I think it's too much a slap on the wrist. I mean, he should be in jail. I really hope that there will be some kinds of investigation and legal proceeding against him, like criminal charges, particularly for the destroying of evidence, obstruction of justice, as well as the sexual violence that he committed. But I actually don't think that it's going to discourage anyone. I think that for the most part, the powerful media men are waiting till this dies down, maybe a bit. But I don't think that as long as they can keep their positions, as long as the structures of power are such that it's mostly men up there, and as long as people recognize that it's money that's doing all of the talking and all of the work, then it's just going to continue. I mean, I think it's the generalized inequality really lets this kind of, you know, this exploitation of one's position, it's what lets it occur. These massive salaries, right, let people feel like they can get away with anything. Everybody, the kind of power that someone like Moonves would have over the careers of so many people, right, their chances, it lets them get away with anything.
We're speaking from Geneva, New York with Dr. Jody Dean. She's a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and her latest book is Crowds and Party.
Les Moonves You know, he set up something called the Commission on Eliminating Sexual Harassment and Advancing Equality in the Workplace, which is chaired Anita Hill. He did this after the Weinstein story and the Bill Cosby story broke. Clearly, he was trying to present himself as a champion of the Me Too movement. And it was only then that all of these women came out who came forward, who had been employees at CBS, and talked about the fact that he was forcing himself on them for years, for decades, and not just one or two women, women across the board, and everybody knew about it. CBS, now they could tolerate the same predator, the same abuser, setting up a commission for the equality of women to in order to protect and cover themselves. The whole thing, when it comes to corporate America being able to address this, is nothing but a scam. The only way the truth has come out at all is when women and men who care have come forward and really forcibly made this an issue in the workplace and in society.
Brian, I have to tell you, when the Weinstein news broke and Les Moonves made that announcement that he had hired Anita Hill, I thought, wow, here's one of the good guys. This is the way corporate leadership should be doing things. You have to protect people in your workforce. You have to make them understand that you're serious about protecting their interests, that nobody should be exposed to that kind of abuse. And then the truth came out about Les Moonves. It seems to me that this is really a part of American corporate culture. These executives, these rich people, have gotten away with this kind of behavior for so long that they're having to react now to a change in reality.
Yeah, it's not an individual problem. It's an institutional problem. It's a societal problem. Go ahead, Jody. We have 1 minute left.
This also makes me think that the problem goes beyond corporate America, because I'm thinking about the Kavanaugh hearings, right? What we saw was Brett Kavanaugh still get to the Supreme Court, right? He was presented himself as a victim, that he was the one who was somehow being, having his reputation tarnished. And so this problem goes further than corporate culture into the basic structure of U.S. society, of U.S. government, right? There's a boys club of wealthy white men who want to protect their privilege, and they protect the privilege of each other. And they do this to the detriment of women, to the detriment of people of color, to the detriment of the rest of us. I mean, I also think it might not be an accident that the celebrity who has gotten some of the most pushback for sexual violence is Bill Cosby, right? He went to jail. And is it, why aren't these white guys going to jail? I mean, it's because the whole system is rotten to the core.
Jody Dean is right, John.
She is right. We were very happy to be joined by Jody Dean. She joined us from Geneva, New York. She is a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. And check out her latest book. It's called Crowds and Party. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. U.S. negotiators in Abu Dhabi yesterday met with members of the Taliban leadership and representatives of the Afghan government to discuss a possible peace in Afghanistan. It's possible that the Taliban and government delegations could meet face-to-face for the very first time. The talks were supposed to last 1 day, but they've stretched into a second, raising hopes of substantive advances. We're joined from Washington by Dr. Marvin Weinbaum. He's the scholar-in-residence and director of the Middle East Institute's Center for Pakistan and Afghanistan Studies. Dr. Weinbaum, welcome back.
Thank you.
So should we be excited about this, or are we so early in the process that we really can't draw any conclusions yet?
Well, look, I think we will know it when we see it, but at least in the first day, the Taliban remained pretty adamant that they had no intention of talking to the representatives from Kabul, who were present, apparently, ready to talk. But to go back and now say, okay, we'll sit, this would represent a major break in what has been their position that the Kabul government is illegitimate. And after all, what they want out of these talks is not, until proven otherwise, is not some kind of grand compromise. What they want out of it is a withdrawal of foreign forces. Because that would be tantamount to a surrender. Everyone agrees that too precipitous a withdrawal, surely without a stabilized situation in Afghanistan, would lead very quickly to a collapse of the Afghan security forces. It's hard to imagine that they would be able at this point to stand on their own.
I was struck, too, by the number of countries that are attending these talks as observers. It's not just the UAE, and of course the United States is involved, but the Saudis are there, the Pakistanis are there, the Indians are there. Should we draw any conclusions from that? Is there anybody encouraging the two sides from outside the country? Are the Pakistanis trying to get the Taliban to make some concessions, and maybe the Indians trying to get the Afghan government to make concessions? Or is this a get to know you session?
No, I think that with the Indians are very concerned about what kind of, everyone is worried about what kind of a deal, if one were ever struck, would result. Because, every country naturally is looking after its own interests. As far as the Pakistanis are concerned, they want to satisfy the Saudis, who have just given them perhaps as much as $6 billion, pumped it into their economy. The Saudis want to please the United States by promoting peace. So we've got there. Pakistan also wants to please the United States, get the United States off its back as it sees it, by showing that it is going the extra step. Now, it did apparently encourage the Taliban to attend, but I don't think it took very much to encourage them to talk to the Americans. They've said that they would talk to the United States right along. Now, it would be something if the Pakistan, particularly, and the other countries, again, now put such pressure on the Taliban. At least those Taliban who were there, which doesn't mean the insurgency in general, on those Taliban to get them to sit down finally and agree to talk with the Kabul government. Now, all that said, that doesn't take you very far. All it does is mean that finally people are talking about something conceivably called substance rather than procedure. And there's a gulf here. There's enormous space here between sitting down and reaching an agreement. And the trouble is that too many people are conflating these, thinking, well, if they agree to talk, then that's where, that's what we're going to have is finally a peace. No, it doesn't mean that at all. All it means is that's the beginning of a process of trying to reach an agreement. And as I tweeted this morning on this very subject, I said, what we have to recognize is that the fundamental problem here, the obstacle, the foremost obstacle, is that until proven otherwise, the Taliban have a different vision for what they believe an Afghanistan government and society should look like. And that ultimately, I think, is irreconcilable with what the Kabul government and the international community have in mind.
Well, then what would successful talks look like to you?
Well, it would be where they sit down and they really hammer out a compromise. I've got the feeling that if that's what the Taliban wanted, if it wanted to get the best deal, and I should mention it enters such talks from what has to be viewed as a relative position of strength. That's where you want to be. You don't want to be, as I think the Kabul government is, in a position at this point of weakness. So they would demand, I think, in those talks, that they proceed really with that vision that they have, which is ultimately the restoration of an Islamic emirate, that the talks really be on their terms, on how the international community and the Afghan government and its and supporters can agree to accept such an Islamic emirate, to which the Taliban would say, we will give you certain concessions, rather than the other way around, which is what it's been, where the government and national community says, well, join our political system and we'll give you elections and you can run as a political party and you'll get a governorship here. Maybe you'll be able to control some of the provinces. Well, the Taliban have always been pretty clear in saying that's not what they want. Could they change their mind? Perhaps, but why should they when they think they're winning?
The U.S. delegation is led by Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad. Zal is the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, the former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, and former senior director at the National Security Council. He's well known in conservative foreign policy circles. What is he going to demand in these talks? The United States, of course, is going to have to come away looking like the winners here. What would that look like?
What the U.S. is looking for is a way out, and it has been loath to simply pick up its marbles and leave, because, as I say, this would lead to a collapse behind. This would look too much like Vietnam, so that's not going to happen. Then again, there might be a tweet tomorrow which says just that. It's hard to say. I think Khalilzad wants here is he wants to deliver something. He'd like to come out of this the way Holbrooke came out of the Balkans. That's what he's looking for, and he's been given that mandate. If he comes back empty-handed, some would, I think, rightly conclude this might be the trigger here for that tweet that says, let's cut our losses and leave. And we'll let the Afghans sort this out for themselves. Well, if they do, of course, that's not going to be a Taliban takeover. It's going to be civil war, because there is no uniform command on either the Taliban or the insurgency, which also includes the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, which has been reviving itself, as well as other groups that want no part to any kind of negotiations.
We have about a minute and a half left, and I want to ask you a question. Well, this is really just a personal question. You know, I spent 15 years with the CIA, and much of that was in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And one of the things that I just never could wrap my head around, and I hope you can shed some light on it, is why after all these years, after more than 17 years, the Afghan security forces and the Afghan military are still just unable to provide security in the country. Was this a problem in training? Is this a tribal issue? What happened that these organizations still are just on the brink of falling apart after all these years and the billions of dollars that have been spent in training?
Yeah, well, we did get a late start, though. We were not doing that kind of training from the beginning. So it's not been 17 years. Part of it is just being the fact of being on the defensive. In order to defeat a guerrilla movement, you need multiple more people on the ground. You need really enormous firepower to do that. We waited too long in any event. By the time we got serious about it, the Taliban had already pretty much established themselves within certainly the rural areas of the country. They can be much more flexible than the government, which is holding defensive positions. But the government has been faced with desertions and the rest. And I think your question's a good one. One would have expected more, but it's not that the Afghans are ever afraid to fight. They're pretty good fighters. And they have, and many have demonstrated an enormous amount of courage. So I don't think we want to put them down completely. But they're up against a difficult force, particularly to that extent that there was sanctuary in Pakistan. That made enormous difference, particularly early on.
Well, that was the voice of Dr. Marvin Weinbaum. He's the scholar in residence and director of the Middle East Institute's Center for Pakistan and Afghanistan Studies. We were happy to have him. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll come back after a short message.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
In a speech marking the 40th anniversary of China's economic reforms, President Xi Jinping vowed to continue market liberalization but made no major policy announcements. He asserted the importance of a strong Communist Party and Communist Party control of the economy and society, and said in reference to the United States that no master can control the Chinese people. Meanwhile, the intelligence chiefs of the Five Eyes countries met in Nova Scotia to discuss Chinese electronics giant Huawei. We're joined from London by John Ross, senior fellow at Chungyang Institute, Renmin University of China. He is also an award-winning resident columnist with several Chinese media organizations. John Ross, welcome back.
Hello.
John, thank you for joining. Let's talk about the big takeaway, or your big takeaway, of what Xi Jinping was emphasizing in the speech marking the 40th anniversary of China's opening up.
Well, I thought there were two aspects. One was the obviously immediate historical importance of this, because it has to be said, you know, China's economic growth since 1978 is unparalleled in human history. There has never been such a sustained record of growth of approximately 9% a year for 40 years in the whole of human history. Never before have so many people been affected by this. You know, over 1.3 billion people, with 800 million people almost being taken out of poverty. So, one, he has to mark the historical importance of this. But secondly, obviously, he's speaking in a very presidential way. He's not going to attack somebody else. But he makes it very clear that China's course has been successful for China and is going to continue on this course. And I thought the definite message that was given was China will continue with the course that it has been successful for it, and it will not be put off course by anybody else. This is which was picked up, for example, by the Financial Times or Bloomberg, who wanted to attack that a lot because, of course, they want to knock China off its successful course. So he was sent in a coded message on that, I thought.
John Ross is our guest. John, two things. I'm looking at Foreign Affairs Today, which is the magazine of the Council on Foreign Relations, which at one time was the go-to think tank for the U.S. government, supplying frequently the secretaries of state, secretaries of defense. Its star has been eclipsed somewhat, but still it's an important magazine. The headline from today is How China Hid Its Global Ambitions, The Stealth Superpower. I mean, it's kind of an amazing headline. And again, today, there was nothing that the Chinese did that was in secret, that wasn't a stealth operation. In fact, when China opened up, when it had the opening up, when Deng Xiaoping came shortly thereafter and met with Jimmy Carter here in Washington, D.C. in January 1979, far from being hidden, it was not only understood and recognized, but actually celebrated by Western powers. And we were also reading many texts in the last couple of days, including a full supplement in the New York Times on Sunday, about why the U.S. policymakers, how U.S. think tanks got it all wrong because they were certain that China would fail, meaning they were certain that if China brought Western corporations and Western think tanks into China, that ultimately the Chinese Communist Party would be dislodged from power. Anyway, your reactions.
Well, I think that the article shows why Foreign Affairs has declined from its previous state of eminence, because there's nothing secret about China at all. And secondly, I'm sorry, but the interpretations of China are examples of arrogance. The ambition of the Chinese people is extremely simple and very similar to the ambition of the American people. They want to have a prosperous life, be happy, you know, live with their families, have a good time, have a better standard of living, and so on and so forth. So, you know, the idea that the Chinese people are sitting somewhere, they're plotting world domination or something, is completely and absolutely ridiculous. They just want a normal life and the best possible life. But this has consequences. China is almost one in five of the people in the world. If China achieves a reasonable standard of living, it's going to be a very important country. And it's not aggressing anybody. I mean, it hasn't got hundreds of military bases around the world in the way the U.S. has. It's not invading a lot of countries. in the way that the US has. It just doesn't want to be interfered with, and it wants to have a reasonable standard of living. And therefore, all these are, and there's nothing secret about that. Deng Xiaoping made it very clear. He wanted, you know, the Chinese people, he said, socialism's got nothing to do with being poor. It is the basis that you should be prosperous, and this prosperity should be relatively evenly distributed. No, there's nothing secret about it. He's got 1,000 pages translated into English. Anybody can read what he wanted to do. But unfortunately, some people in the West had the arrogant idea that they knew better than what China said, what China wanted, and they're just being proved to be wrong. So it's a sort of collapse of their illusions. It's not anything to do with China at all.
I was watching a video last night. It's a short video. It was produced by the Chinese government, but it was a visit of Xi Jinping to this very remote village. I can't remember exactly where, but it was in the southwest part of the country. And he comes and he brings his entourage and he comes to meet with the villagers and he goes into their homes. And the thing that struck me about it was he's talking to them after the meeting. He says, you know, when I first came here, the grinding poverty was so impressive. It made him so depressed, he says, because people had no access to roads. They were constantly being overcome by natural disasters and mudslides. Their kids couldn't get to school. They didn't have a potable water. And I thought, wow, you know, like, this is so different. Like, the American president would never go someplace and talk about, oh, our country has such grinding poverty. It makes me depressed. Poverty is completely hidden. It's completely put somewhere else. You're not supposed to even know about it. Michael Harrington wrote a book about poverty in the 1960s, and it became a big thing because
yes, he did.
Kennedy and the Whiz Kids read it, and they said, oh, there's all this poverty in America, where if you just drove around huge parts of America, people were living in shacks. Anyway, it's just a different sense of perspective and governance. I'm not talking about ideology here. I'm talking about presentation. Go ahead.
Well, I think it's only presentation. I think it's content. I mean, look at the situation in the United States at the present time. Although the United States, obviously, a much richer country than China. It will take several decades for China to catch up with that. But America is going backwards. The most sensitive indicator, it's well known to economists, of overall human well-being is average life expectancy, because it sums up everything which is good, you know, high income, good education, good health care, and subtracts everything which is negative, poverty, lack of education, bad health care, etc., and sums up in one figure. Well, average life expectancy in the United States has fallen in the last couple of years. This is horrific. And the situation in China is that life expectancy, which is the best indication of that, continues to go up. I mean, the way that people should approach the situation in China is they should celebrate this. They say this is absolutely fantastic. Nearly 800 million people have been lifted out of poverty. This is wonderful. Then they can go on to make some criticism. There's the lack of this or lack of that, or this could be improved, or problems which the Chinese people would be first to acknowledge. You know, they've got bad air quality. That was because they had some excessively rapid growth. There are still about 20 million people living in absolute poverty. It's been reduced from 800 million, but nevertheless, it's a big task to get the last 20 million out because they're often living in very remote places in the country, and in some cases, you can't. You've got to move them. It's impossible to build the infrastructure. But, you know, you've got to have a sense of balance. There are problems. I always say that to my friends in the West. Look, are you saying there are problems in China? I can give you a list as long as my arm, and the Chinese people can give you even one that's even longer than mine. But is there a crisis that is something that's going to stop the country going forward? The answer is no. So therefore, the whole approach is totally wrong. Instead of saying this is absolutely wonderful, never in the whole of human history has so many people's lives been improved, and then go on to add, well, but of course, you know, necessarily there is this and that setback. But the whole perspective is totally wrong, totally ideological, totally propaganda, and therefore, frankly, incidentally, has absolutely no effect on the Chinese people, because they know perfectly well that their lives are improving.
John Russ is our guest. John, we have just a little less than a minute. One thing that I was struck in the coverage of Xi Jinping's speech, I'm looking at Global Times, the emphasis on socialism with Chinese characteristics. At least in this one article and editorial, it's emphasized over and over and over again. The formulation, socialism with Chinese characteristics isn't mentioned once or twice. In other words, not just a box-checking exercise. It seems to be a point of emphasis. Is that your read, too, of this speech? Again, very short amount of time, about 40 seconds.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been studying China's economy since 1978 with the start of the economic reform. I've been writing on it in 1992. China is exactly what it says on the can. It's not capitalism. It's socialism with Chinese characteristics, and it's been tremendously successful, and other countries can learn from it. That's what Xi Jinping said, and he's totally right and in accord with the facts.
That was the voice of John Ross. John Ross is a senior fellow at Chengyang Institute, Renmin University of China. John is also an award-winning resident columnist with several Chinese media organizations. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short message, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Trump administration earlier this year laid out plans to weaken emission controls on vehicles. The changes were so dramatic that even automakers balked at the notion of making and selling dirtier cars and trucks. But it turns out that another group was behind the push. The New York Times reports that it was U.S. oil companies leading the charge to allow cars and trucks to emit more pollution. We're joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff. He's professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation. That's available from Monthly Press Review. Fred, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back.
Fred, why fix something if it's not broken? If even the car manufacturers are not complaining to the federal government about emissions standards, why weaken them? What's the positive there?
The positive is the oil company is going to make more money. That's what they're after. That's the name of the game. And so weakening the standards means that there will be more gasoline used in the future than there would have been otherwise, and because the cars won't be as efficient. And so that means they'll be able to sell more gasoline and refine more oil, and they will be more profitable.
You know, that's the thing that I just simply don't understand. Here we are in an era of the electric car and hydrogen cell cars. I saw my first hydrogen cell car just the other day. It was a Mercedes-Benz. It was beautiful. And then you've got the oil companies that seem to be dictating the narrative here, where it's not the oil companies that should be dictating the narrative. It's the automakers. It's the automakers that should be working with the Environmental Protection Agency and other elements of the federal government to make things more efficient. Because isn't it true, Fred, that most of these oil companies led by ExxonMobil actually make more money from downstream industries than they do from oil and gas?
Well, it's normally the case. I don't know if all of them, but yes, that's normally the case. Usually there's a certain amount to be made off of the actual oil, and then there's the refining, and then there's, you know, the gas stations, the distribution system and everything, and there are various products aside from gasoline that are also made from petroleum. So, yeah, I think a good, you know, more than 50% of the profits are in the downstream, if you will, part of the industry.
I want to read from the New York Times, because people think that the auto manufacturers don't want this, but of course, some others do. When the Trump administration laid out a plan this year that would eventually allow cars to emit more pollution, automakers, the obvious winners from the proposal, balked. The changes, they said, went too far even for them. But it turns out that there was a hidden beneficiary of the plan that was pushing for the changes all along, the nation's oil industry. In Congress, on Facebook, and in state houses nationwide, Marathon Petroleum, the country's largest refiner, worked with powerful oil industry groups and conservative policy network financed by the billionaire industrialist Charles Koch to run a stealth campaign to roll back car emission standards, according to this investigation by the Times. Yes. This is a criminal effort to sort of not drain the swamp, but to make the swamp ever more dominant in terms of determining policy. Fred Magdoff, if we think back to 40 or 50 years ago, before auto emission standards were as they are now, there was just so much more air pollution in the United States.
Oh, for sure. Well, there was air pollution for other reasons also, you know, from the electric, power companies, and, there are other sources. But certainly per car on the road, there was quite a bit more, you know, pollution at that time. But don't forget, we got a lot more vehicles now using a lot more gasoline, even if they're more efficient than those older vehicles were. You know, it's the number of vehicles times the efficiency, which is really the issue, or the miles per gallon. So, I mean, this is definitely a step backwards, though. And the way they couch it, that it gives people a choice. It's not clear what in the world they're talking about, because where's the choice here? You're not getting any choice. You're not given the option of having a more fuel efficient vehicle. You're just given one option, which is to have a less fuel-efficient vehicle.
Yeah. It seems that the United States, I want to ask you about this. The United States, under the Trump administration, has clearly taken a major step backward, not even a professed commitment to reduce carbon emissions. In fact, a professed commitment to expand them. And also, I read, I think it was Noam Chomsky did an analysis of the highway safety report that said, you know, global warming is real. Climate change is real. It's going to be very pronounced. It's going to have a dire effect. And the recommendations of the National Highway Safety Report was to do just this, to relax auto emissions, because the argument was that auto emissions by themselves are just a small part of the problem. The problem is real, and the real problem can create catastrophes, according to the National Safety Highway Report. But because auto emissions only make up a fraction of the problem, let it rip. Let's go back. I mean, something like that. I mean, it's. I think Chomsky called it crazy, irrational, and criminal. And it's clearly all of those things.
Well, and it's also very misleading, because you know, the burning of gasoline is one of the major sources. It's true. It's only a fraction of the total, but it's only, you know, it is one of the major sources of carbon dioxide emissions, you know, globally. So anything that can cut that down somewhat at least helps to a little bit. You know, it's definitely not going to solve the problem, but at least it doesn't make it worse, which is what they want to do, which is actually, it's actually going to make it to make the environment in worse shape. And the automakers, I think they were not very happy about this, what the oil companies are trying to do, because they've already planned it. They're already planning to institute you know, policies. I mean, you know, to build cars that conform to the new standards. They wanted a little bit of a relaxation of the standards, but they didn't want them to do away with them.
I wonder if this is going to end up in the courts. If you've got an administration that is not just refusing to lead, but it's abdicating leadership on these environmental issues, in which we've made some progress over the last, you know, couple of decades, I wonder if the only alternative then is to just start suing, because it seems like there would be so many people and organizations with standing that maybe that's how we ought to be looking at this.
Well, I'm sure there are folks looking into it right now. That is definitely a very important approach to dealing with environmental problems, is to use the legal system. So I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, there is the issue that has not been worked out yet, is that California has relatively stringent control, you know, standards for their emissions from automobiles. And basically, I think what the government is going to want to do, the national government is going to want to do away with California's ability to do that, because there are 11 other states that basically go along with California. And the last thing the auto companies want is two different standards. One that's California and 11 other states, and then another one, which is for the rest of the country. So there are a lot of folks that are going to be unhappy with it, some of them relatively influential. So I wouldn't be surprised that this goes to court from different points of view.
Yeah, of course. You know, this is an important issue. I mean, the whole point of having a modern nation state is, part of it is to deal with commerce within the borders of the nation state, to have them regulated, to have them be uniform, especially in a country like the United States, where there are 50 states. The whole idea of interstate commerce would be completely disrupted, especially in such a vital part of the economy as vehicles, autos and trucks and motorcycles. If in fact California and 10 other states won't allow the sale in their states of the same cars that are allowed in other states. So ultimately, in order for the industry to thrive, and that will, I think, become a determinant of this, there has to be uniformity, at least, either going back to or improving auto emissions or relaxing them such as what Donald Trump hopes to do, and have this become the federal government being the catalyst for the end of the progressive state actions to limit carbon emissions.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a pivotal time. And I mean, what's happened in the past is sort of California led the way, and then, you know, the rest of the country conformed, and then Congress, you know, basically caught up with California. And yes, I think it will be very difficult for the automobile companies to be producing two different types of automobiles. So I think what the administration will do would probably be to go after California, you know, legally, to try to stop them from having this ability to set their own standards.
Indeed, we will leave it there. We were joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff. He's Professor Emeritus of Plant and Soil Science at the University of Vermont and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation from Monthly Review Press. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.